First is from the book of Genesis in chapter 25. If you want to read along, it's verses 19 through 34. This story has become, I really first thought about it in seminary, and it's the story of the birth of Esau and Jacob twins, and the conflict that was theirs from before they were born. And the conclusion of the story is Jacob swindling his brother out of his birthright. So the birthright is this: the oldest son had more inheritance than the younger son or sons. And so since they're twins, it's kind of ridiculous, but Esau did get out of the womb first, and so he was entitled to more of an inheritance than Jacob, and Jacob swindled him out of that. The story functions on just so many levels. Esau really represents the nation of Edom, and Jacob the nation of Israel. And so there's some sort of making fun of the nation of Edom in this story. But of course, it functions on a very, very archetypal level of divisions within families. You know, we're still dealing with family of origin issues, right? And they just get projected on large across the screen of our social and cultural milieu. So the more things change, the more they stay the same. Let us, as we look at this story once again, listen for God to speak to us through this word. These are the descendants of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Paddan Aram, sister of Laban the Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and his wife Rebekah conceived. The children struggled together within her. And she said, "If it is to be this way, why do I live?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The elder shall serve the younger." When her time to give birth was at hand, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy mantle. So they named him Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand gripping Esau's heel. So he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man, living in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking a stew, Esau came in from the field and he was famished. Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stuff, for I am famished." Therefore, he was called Edom, which means red. Jacob said, "First sell me your birthright." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. And next we turn to Matthew's gospel in chapter 13. We read verses 1 through 9, then we skip a section. We take it up at verse 18 to 23 again, if you want to follow along. A very familiar parable of Jesus. That same day, Jesus went out of the house and sat beside the sea. Such great crowds gathered around him that he got into a boat and sat there, while the whole crowd stood on the beach. And he told them many things in parables, saying, "Listen, a sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seeds fell on the path, and the birds came and ate them up. Other seeds fell on rocky ground, where they did not have much soil, and they sprang up quickly, since they had no depth of soil. But when the sun rose, they were scorched, and since they had no root, they withered away. Other seeds fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked them. Other seeds fell on good soil and brought forth grain, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. Let anyone with ears listen." Skipping to the next section. Hear then the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what is sown in the heart. This is what was sown on the path. As for what was sown on rocky ground, this is the one who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. Yet such a person has no root, but endures only for a while. And when trouble or persecution arises on account of the word, that person immediately falls away. As for what was sown among thorns, this is the one who hears the word, but the cares of the world and the lure of wealth choke the word, and it yields nothing. But as for what was sown on good soil, this is the one who hears the word and understands it, who indeed bears fruit and yields, in one case 100-fold, in another 60, and in another 30. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So, I'm interested this morning in that section of Matthew's gospel that we did not read. That between the telling of the parable and the explanation of the parable. So, just one comment right off the top. Jesus first just tells a parable, you know, about sowing seeds. Doesn't explain it, just a story about seeds. And that is told to the crowds. Then Jesus is in private, and that's where we have the section that we did not read happen, followed by Jesus' explanation of the parable. And this may sound like a small point if you're not a biblical scholar, but when you explain a parable, it's no longer a parable. It's what we would call an allegory. It's like the same thing. When you explain a joke, you know, really, why bother? And maybe you're protesting because we like the explanation, right? We want to be on the end. We want to know. We want to understand. We want to have the answers. And in an allegory, what happens is it's an explaining of what is hidden. It is, and it has this correspondence that each image corresponds to an explanation or a point of view. So in this story, for instance, the thorn stands for the cares of the world and the lure of wealth. And, you know, there's a sort of arbitrary quality to an allegory. You know, why, you might ask, does a thorn stand for the cares of the world and the lures of wealth? And the only real answer you can give is because Jesus said so. The one who tells the allegory gets to explain the allegory. Now, in a good allegory, the images that are used fit. And I think that this is a good allegory. The whole thing of what happens underneath the soil, right, corresponds to what happens in the soul of the human being or in the depths of our inner space. We live with our attention on the externals, what's above the surface. But what Jesus is interested in is what happens underneath the surface in our hearts. And so in this instance, I think it's a really good allegory. But the point that I really am belaboring at the beginning is that an allegory is not a parable. An allegory explains what is hidden. Where a parable leaves all of the ends untied. It doesn't wrap it up in a bow for us. It lets what's not explained sit there in us. And the way our consciousness works is it gets in our subconscious. And it works on us, works on us, works on us until we find, you know, a satisfying explanation or answer. And so I believe this is a really intentional strategy by Jesus to question us, to make us in some ways uncomfortable, so that we dig deeper and we get below the surface of ourselves and we take a look. A deeper, deeper look at what's going on. So I really think that Jesus' primary way was that of the parable, not the allegory. He did not tell very many allegories, and when he did, it was to help out his closest followers because they were already in with him and engaged with him and already engaged in this process of looking deeper at themselves and leaning into the questions. So, you know, just notice how different that is from our normal tendency. You know, the ego, the human ego loves answers because the answers make us feel powerful and in charge. I've got the information, you know? And so we want to turn spirituality into answers, information. And Jesus knows that the spiritual journey is not primarily about information. It's primarily about living with uncertainty and questions. So why would Jesus make us feel less secure? And I think the answer is because Jesus knows we really can't begin the spiritual journey until in really fundamental ways we begin to see that we're not secure on ourselves, to understand that, and to begin to seek for God in a deep and humble and honest way. So, now I'm ready to turn to the section that we didn't read, okay? So, the crowds, you know, they get away from the crowds, and the disciples come up to Jesus, and they say, Jesus, why are you talking to people in parables, right? Why aren't you speaking more plainly? Why aren't you giving them answers? And this is what Jesus says to their question. He says, the reason I talk to them in parables is that they look without seeing and listen without hearing or understanding. They look without seeing. They listen without hearing or understanding. Again, this goes against our grain, right? We would think, well, that's why you should tell them the answers. But Jesus says, this is why I speak to them in parables. Why? Maybe I'll get them thinking, searching, longing, questioning. Then he quotes this passage from Isaiah. He says, you will listen and listen again, but not understand, and see again, and not perceive. For the heart of this nation has grown coarse. Their ears are dull of hearing, and they have shut their eyes, for fear they should see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their heart, and be converted and be healed by me. Jesus shares the conviction with Isaiah that just because, you know, you're part of the so-called chosen people of God, right? You're part of the chosen people. You're part of the true faith, the true religion. That doesn't mean that just because you are part of that group, that you really want to see and understand the truth about yourself and the world. Jesus shared with Isaiah the conviction that God's people really were not open to and interested in understanding the truth about themselves and the world. Because if they opened themselves, they would have to be converted over and over and over again. In other words, they didn't want to really see and hear, because if they really saw that, it would take them on a journey of ongoing change and growth, moving their focus away from their self-obsession onto the ways of God, which are the ways of loving the neighbor. What they do want and what they choose to do is to pretend that by virtue of being a part of, you know, God's chosen people, that they are all that, and that they don't have to change at all. They've already arrived. They don't have to engage in any hard work of self-observation and self-criticism and humility and repentance. All of their time, rather, is spent on a much more satisfying habit of self-justification and self-defense and pointing the finger at others. It's a cheap way of propping up a shaky sense of self. And what Jesus said is that such a habitual stance of self-defensiveness is really poor soil for spiritual growth. Jesus knew that until something really different takes place in the inner core of ourselves, that nothing truly fruitful, spiritually speaking, can happen in us. And in the allegorical explanation of the parable, he says the seed is the word of the kingdom. And we know that for Jesus, the kingdom is within us. It's an inner quality of the heart. It is among us. It's a quality of our relationship with one another that's reflective of the Spirit, reflective of the Trinity. It's the real possibility of a human heart becoming deeply opened and surrendered to God and alive to the way of love, which is God's eternal nature. And so the call to each one of us is to examine daily what's going on inside of our hearts. And if we do that, we will be humbled. Are we surrendering our ego needs in any moment to the movements of love within and among us? And if we are, then we're being prodded constantly towards a posture of forgiveness, to an intention to deeply see the other person who's in front of us, to deeply try to understand them and to love and support them in their journey, not to fix them, not to change them, but to love them unconditionally and wholeheartedly. So last night when I got home to Rumson, I turned on looking for a movie, and I saw the Tom Hanks Mr. Rogers movie, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Have any of you seen the movie? If you haven't, I really recommend it. Just this beautiful reminder of what is possible for people, right? That instead of being in a defensive, judging posture, right, hardening ourselves against the other, judging the other, what could happen if we tried to understand the other, the brokenness of the other, to love that other? to see that other at their core. What a gift. What a gift. And I just thank God that I saw that movie, because, you know, when you turn on the news, you see the exact opposite, right? You just see this same old defensive posture and blaming posture. And it's all based in fear. And I think what Jesus would say to us is that that soil is no good for spiritual fruit. It's hard, it's rocky, it's filled with thorns, and it is not serving the movements of God in us and among us. And so what can Jesus do? What can any of us do to help people do the work of preparing our souls, making it fertile soil for the work of the Spirit? You know, is it to engage in a frontal assault upon people and put a finger in their face and to point out, man, you are just blind. You're spiritually blind, right? That works real well, doesn't it? Or is it to tell a story? A story which might touch the heart, which might plant a seed that you may never see the result of, but trusting that there is a seed of God in every human heart that eventually might crack open the hardest of hearts. You know, I take both displeasure and hope by the reality of how weeds can crack through anything, right? Just go along, you'll see them cracking through concrete or through asphalt. You know, the strength of these little seeds, these weeds, when you're trying to make your yard look perfect is discouraging. But if we're thinking about it spiritually speaking, if we just practice touching into our own hearts and respecting that there is a living heart in the other, what miracles the Spirit might be able to perform with that. So I'm just going to end with some really brief reflections on the story that we read this morning in Genesis about these two twins, Esau and Jacob. It's, to me, one of the most compelling stories in all of the Bible. That you have these twins, right, who are set up for conflict even before they're born. You know, they're at war in the womb to their mother's displeasure. And when they come out of the womb, the younger one, Jacob, is grasping onto the heel of the older brother as if to say, no, 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 you know, wait your turn. I'm gonna pass you, man. And so, and then they're different, right? So just by being different, automatically we're tempted to be in conflict and opposition. So Esau is the prototypical man's man, right? He's an outdoorsman, he's a hunter, he's a sportsman, you know, and he is daddy's favorite. And Jacob, you know, I guess we would call him a mama's boy. He's quiet, you know, he stays in the tents. He's not out there in the fields. He's not out there doing the man stuff, right? You know, he's writing poetry or something like that, or reading books. I mean, really. And so, you know, just by their differences they're set up, and by the fact that mom and dad have their favorites, they're set up. And really, there's almost no hope for them to have a fruitful relationship unless somehow they find a way of breaking out of those limitations that the culture and our own personality structures put on us, where we feel threatened by difference, where we feel uncomfortable, where we feel a need to compete, where we feel the need to justify ourselves and put the other down. And then we have, you know, allies in the journey and the family, and it's, again, it gets played out on a global scale over and over again. And the only hope is if they find a new self. And we don't get to that point in the story, but they do eventually. Life beats them both up. They get humbled. They discover a spiritual source. And eventually it enables them to take the journey of letting go, which is necessary for any reconciliation. But at this point in the story, all we have is hurt. and conflict. And Jacob swindles the birthright from Esau. And that's where the story leaves off. So I think the story has the potential to get us to be looking at ourselves and to look at the characters in the story and to begin to see how we may be like them in various ways. How do we defend our territory? How do we judge? How do we engage in conflicts? How do we perpetuate conflict? How do we resist moving to reconciliation? How are we like Esau, who gave away his birthright for, you know, a bowl of soup and a piece of bread? And, you know, maybe we don't give our financial position away for such, but if our birthright, scripturally speaking, is a depth of a spiritual life, a spiritual commitment that is front and center and core of who we are, you know, how are we like Esau that we throw that away for the sake of stuff like money and stuff and, you know, food and drink, where that becomes the focus of our lives instead of the presence of God within us? And again, the story of Mr. Rogers, who, without using that Christian language, lived it. He was a Presbyterian minister, after all. Lived it. He saw the Christ. He fought to see the Christ each moment in himself and in the neighbor, as difficult as that is. How are we like Jacob, right? Thinking that we can compromise, let's put it this way, on our ethics, you know, and hope to find the true treasures of life in doing so, right? Thinking that the true gifts of life are available to us by means that are less than deeply loving and integral, right? How are we like that? So is that what these stories are saying to us? You know, what's it saying to you as you think about it, as you read it, as you open yourselves to it? As Jesus was fond of saying to us over and over again, let those with ears to hear listen. Let those with eyes to see perceive why we are here. May it be so. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.